Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Sarah Stevens, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching citizens practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in the government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. I will now turn the time over to Bryce Christensen, the president of the U-Republicans at the University of Utah.
Thank you, Sarah. I have the opportunity to introduce Senator Bennett here today. I first met the senator. I took his class over the summer. He's a part-time lecturer here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and I asked him if he would do an event with the College Republicans, and he agreed, and now we're here. We're co-sponsoring this with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Pizza is on the way. It will be in the back. We also have bottled water and information for the College Republicans here. By way of introduction, the senator was born on September 18, 1933, here in Utah. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in political science in 1958. He was also the student body president, 1957. Okay. He was also the student body president here at the University of Utah. Some highlights, he served as a chief congressional liaison in the U.S. Department of Transportation. He's a CEO for the Franklin Institute, and he also served as a senator from 1933 to 2011. And with that, I will now... 33 from when he was born in 33. He served as a senator in 93. Thank you. 1993 to 2011, and I will now turn the time over to Senator Bob Bennett. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted to be with you, and I understand the pizza is on its way, and I don't want to be an impediment for you to getting to the pizza. So we will talk through the process of having you leave your seat and go get the pizza and come back. I have a lot of things on my mind, but that's not appropriate in this kind of a setting. We should talk about what is on your mind. So I'll tell you one of my favorite little snippets out of my Washington experience. When Madeleine Albright came before the Appropriations Committee for the first time after she had been appointed Secretary of State, she said to us, "Mr. Chairman, I have an opening statement, and according to the people who wrote it, it's brilliant." She said, "I will file it for the committee's consideration and respond to your questions." So let's assume that I have given you my opening statement, and let's stipulate that it was brilliant, and I will now respond to whatever questions you might have. And if you don't have any, why, this is going to be a very short forum. The first one, yes, sir.
When you have a question, can you guys just stand up, state your name, say a little bit about yourself? Because I think if you're in the class, you need your name to get credit. So, and then just come to the aisle so that I can get it for you, if you don't mind.
Hello, Senator. I'm Noel DeNevers. I'm an emeritus professor. Would you talk about the future of the Tea Party and the Republican Party and where you think that's going?
The future of the Tea Party and the Republican Party and where I think that's going. Well, that could take the whole hour, but I will do my best to condense it. I have two historical allusions that kind of guide me in terms of my thoughts about the Tea Party, one of them here in Utah and one of them nationally. The Utah allusion, we've had the Tea Party kind of attitude in Utah for as long as I've been aware of politics here. And the principal figure of the old-time Tea Party was, by coincidence, named Lee. It was Governor J. Bracken Lee. And for those of you too young to remember Governor Lee, this was an example of his attitude towards the federal government. He refused to pay his income taxes on the basis that the 16th Amendment was not properly ratified. therefore was not constitutional, therefore the income tax system was not constitutional, therefore he had no obligation to pay his taxes. So here is the governor of the state of Utah refusing to pay his income taxes. And for that he received national recognition. He was the darling of the Birch Society and others of that particular persuasion for a long period of time. He was elected twice as governor of Utah, ran for the third time, and by that time the divisions within the party in Utah were so severe that we had one of the nastiest primary sessions that I think we've ever had in our history. The senior senator from Utah, whose name was Arthur Watkins, leading what today we would call establishment Republicans, was determined that Governor Lee, leading to what today we would call Tea Party Republicans, would not be renominated. And Senator Watkins led the effort to get George D. Clyde nominated in the Republican Party. He was successful in the Republican primary. Clyde won the primary. Lee ran for governor as an independent in the three-party fight. It was 1956. Eisenhower at the top of the ticket. The Republicans swept all before them. And Clyde was elected governor. Lee then came back in 1958, filed as an independent right from the beginning, and ran against Senator Watkins. 1958 was not a good year for Republicans, and Ted Moss was elected senator with 38% of the vote in the final election, with Lee and Watkins splitting the Republican vote and allowing Moss to take the seat, which he held for 18 years. I think that's a historic example of what could happen to the Republican Party in the state of Utah by virtue of the Tea Party. It eventually played itself out. Lee came back to Salt Lake City and got himself elected mayor. And he was mayor of Salt Lake for, I think, two terms. He ran against my father in 1962, as a Republican. He came back to the party. He said, I'm tired of being in the wilderness. I want to come back to the party. Ran within the primary. My father beat him in the primary, and Lee then stayed in the party. And that great rift ultimately healed. But the whole thing boiled over again when you get somebody else named Lee, not related to Jay Bracken in any way. And now we have seen the party split. You see it in the papers. You see all of the controversy in the polls. And I think we may very well have a period of turmoil within the party the same way we did in the years of Jay Bracken Lee. Now, if I can shift nationally. People say to me, isn't this the most polarized situation you have ever seen in American politics? And the answer is no. I'm old enough to remember Vietnam and the bitterness that occurred over the question of the wisdom of America's involvement in that war split the nation. And it was so bitter that Lyndon Johnson, who was president of the United States, could not travel to any location in the United States except a military base. If he showed up any place else, the demonstrations against him were so severe and so overwhelming that he and the Secret Service just felt it's not safe for the president to travel anywhere. We have not gotten to that point yet in the ideological divisions in America. Now, within the Democratic Party, there was a group that formed that became the anti-war party, the anti-war wing of the Democratic Party. And for want of a better term, we call them in historic context the McGovernites. They ultimately took over the Democratic Party, nominating their man as the presidential candidate. In my view, historically, the McGovernites were right about the war. The war was a huge mistake. We can go back to the Kennedy brothers and their Secretary of Defense, who guided them and advised them of the wisdom of it, Robert McNamara, that got us in and kept us in because Johnson, after Kennedy's assassination, embraced McNamara and his view of the war as the right view. And through the lens of history, we can look back on that and say that was a terrible mistake, and the McGovernites were right. However, in political terms, they morphed from the anti-war party into the anti-American party, at least in the eyes of the electorate. And with the McGovernites a major voice within the Democratic Party, the Democrats lost 5 out of the next 6 elections. And it wasn't until a former McGovernite who had adjusted his assumptions and changed his view a little about the anti-American side of the anti-war movement, a young fellow by the name of Bill Clinton, who then campaigned in a much more centrist view than the McGovernite view of his youth, that the Democrats became a viable political institution once again as far as the presidency was concerned. I see the same pattern possibly developing. I put the word possibly in because you, with politics, you never know, and no analogy is perfect. I think the driving force behind the Tea Party had much merit. The complaint that the government was too large, the government was too expensive, the government was too unresponsive, I think, had legitimacy. But it has morphed, just the way the McGovernites morphed from the anti-war position into an anti-American position. You had Jane Fonda going to Hanoi and apologizing to the world for America and saying that it was America, not the Soviet Union, that was the primary source of difficulty in the world. And now the Tea Party, starting out from what I consider to be very logical and legitimate concerns, has morphed from what they were to an anti-government party, period. And they are seen as being against any kind of government involvement in our lives. And the American people are showing signs that they are rejecting that notion as firmly as they rejected Jane Fonda. And if the Tea Party becomes the voice of the Republican Party with that perceived agenda as their driving concept, I would predict that the Republicans will lose 5 out of the next 6 elections, just as the Democrats did in the days of the McGovernites. We will see it come to a head in 1916. Right now, the 2 names, and you cannot at this point by any means predict what will happen 3 years from now, but just for academic analysis, for right now, the 2 names that are emerging as the leading candidates for the Republican nomination in 2016 are Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, the anti-government voice, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, the voice for let's get it done. If Chris Christie becomes the nominee, or someone in his portion of the Republican stream, and the Tea Party does not decide we're going to desert the party because of that ideological wound, I think we have an opportunity to recover the presidency for the Republicans in 2016. If Rand Paul becomes the nominee, or one of his subsidiaries, Ted Cruz is fighting him very hard for that slot, I think the Republicans will lose, and we will be in a period of the wilderness for a long time, in the time of the wilderness for a long time to come. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm not a political scientist, although I'm the younger brother of the former chairman of this department. I found your remarks very interesting, although as somebody who campaigned for Eugene McCarthy in 1968, I don't like the idea that the anti-war movement was somehow anti-American.
You didn't start out that way, but never mind.
My question, though, is given that I think over the last several decades, the Republican Party has consistently appealed to various kinds of bigotry, as racism, misogyny, homophobia, anti-scientific Christian fundamentalism. Isn't that appeal to the Christian right partly responsible for the emergence of this extremist group that's now called the Tea Party?
Well, if I may respectfully suggest that not every Republican is going to accept your description of what has happened and why the Republicans have taken some of the positions they have, I will grant you that some of the voices you've described have found a home in the Republican Party. But I'm not yet willing to admit that they have taken over the party or part of the mainstream of the positions of the party. The reality of American politics, which Bill Clinton understood extremely well after his first 2 years. We must remember Bill Clinton's first 2 years were as disastrous as Barack Obama's first 2 years and laid the foundation for the political revulsion against him that occurred in his first off-term election as both Obama and Clinton saw the Republicans do extremely well in that off-year election. But Clinton immediately after that realized this is a center-right country. This is, in European terms, this is a center-right country, and the only way you can govern effectively is to be in that space. And Clinton moved very much into that space. There are those voices in the Republican Party who reject the center part of center-right and say it should be right-right country. And they are as far out of tune with the majority of Americans as those who say, well, let's move into the left part and get out of the center. And those candidates who have won Republican nominations with the positions you've described have lost. A fact that is not wasted on the people within the party who like to win elections. I can name the 6 Senate seats we would have today, which would give us control of the Senate, if it had not been for candidates of the kind you describe. So I don't think it's quite as bad as you have put it.
Okay, one follow-up question?
Surely, quickly.
I don't think we have time.
Okay, they're telling me no. So, yeah.
Senator Bennett, it's an honor to ask you a question here in the forum. My name is George Fifita from Tonga. And my question goes along with what you just said in the last few minutes. We're a center-right nation, but at the same time, you also said politicians who move away from the center alienate themselves from the parties. I'm just wondering, by that particular comment, does it have any resemblance to what was said in the 5,000-year book plan, where it talks about a political scale? A successful government has to be balanced. If we veer to the right, it goes towards tyranny. If it veers to the left, anarchy. Does it have any resemblance, or did you mean something different?
Well, I am not a fan of the 5,000-year book of Dr. Skousen. I always found Dr. Skousen a very pleasant personality, and I enjoyed talking with him, but I didn't embrace most of his political ideas. Let me put it in this context for you. The Democrats are the party of government. They believe in government. If you go to a Democrat, here's a problem. His first reaction is, well, where is the government solution to that problem? The Republicans are the party of free markets. You go to the Republicans and you say, here's a problem, and they say, well, how will the market solve that problem if you get the government out of the way? And the question that I pose to my students, and they know the answer, they've heard this speech, who's right? And the answer is they both are. There are some situations where government does indeed have to intervene in society legitimately and produces good results. And the number one example of that is civil rights. If we had not had the government intervention of the Civil Rights Act, and Civil Rights Acts, there were several, in the 1960s, African Americans and their descendants would still be living in Jim Crow in large sections of the country. And just letting persuasion and religious examples and so on take care of the problem would not have taken care of the problem. You needed the government there. The Democrats were right there. And since you're dealing with constitutional rights that were being denied those people, it is interesting to me as a historical example to point out that the reason those civil rights bills passed is because Republicans, led by Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader in the Senate, and supported by my father, said, you're right. This is one time when government is the right thing to do. The civil rights bills passed because of Lyndon Johnson's leadership, but would not have passed without Everett Dirksen's cooperation and help. I was there at the time as a staffer, and I watched the civil rights bill being written in the Senate by Senator Dirksen. It was not written in the White House by President Johnson. It was written in the Senate by Senator Dirksen, who knew what had to be in it in order to get enough votes to pass it. I love the statement attributed to Senator Dirksen. I will do a poor imitation. You cannot approach the Wizard of Ooz, as he was called, who was then, at one point surrounded by a group of ministers that were talking to him about what he should be doing, and he said, I am not a moralist. I am a legislator. And we need that. Okay. There are some times when the Republicans are right, where the Democrats say government is the solution to this problem, and no, government gets in the way. And we're far better off if we have market solutions and hold down government regulations that cost money, stop innovation, and hurt the economy. It is the tension between these two positions, with strong advocates for both working through the congressional pattern, that has turned out to be the strength of America over time. I was never apologetic about being a strong advocate for free markets. I've studied it, spent my life in it, and I believe strongly that markets make better decisions than government does. But I never apologized for my willingness to step across the aisle and listen to the suggestion that government might do this, that, and the other, because I realized that there were times when that was necessary. That's my view of how I should have reacted in a center-right country. Yes, ma'am. Paid a price for it at the convention, but still proud of it. Yes, ma'am.
My name's Jenica Jessen. My question is partially about what we started with, the political climate in Utah, and partially about the caucus system. Do you think that the Count My Vote initiative is likely to succeed? And if so, will it help the Republican divide in Utah, or will it create hard feelings and just worsen the animosity?
If I had my druthers, and I realize this puts me different from both groups, and it will never pass, so this is just the political scientist in me coming out, I would take Utah to the Washington ballot, or now they're calling it the California ballot, that's what they've decided to do, where it's as it is in our municipal election. You do not have party primaries at all. You don't have conventions, you don't have caucus, you don't have party primary. You have one primary in the state. The top two that come out of that primary are on the general ballot, which I think would be healthy for Utah because in some instances it would be two Republicans. But that kind of a primary would not disenfranchise Democrats and independents who are now forbidden to vote in a Republican primary. And that would ameliorate the divisions that would be there, as the Democrats would say, well, we don't like Senator Bennett, but we'll all get behind another Republican because we realize that the sacrificial lamb Democrats we've been putting up will not cause Senator Bennett to pay any attention to us. So here's a group of Democrats and independents that would be willing to back another Republican that would be willing to take me on whatever situations. If I were in charge, that's what I would do. Now, having said that, Count My Vote calls for an open primary of that kind for each of the two parties and elimination of the caucus system. I would prefer that to the caucus system. And for those who say, oh, but the caucus system is in the tradition of a Republican form of government. That is, a republic means you elect representatives. So the neighbors elect representatives that represent them at the convention. And that is a more pure kind of government than a pure democracy. And we're with Alexander Hamilton and saying we're very suspicious of pure democracy. The one problem with that, from a political science point of view, the delegates you elect vote by secret ballot. So you have no idea whether they have represented you or not. You have no idea what they've done. And I can tell you it happens. In my race against Joe Cannon, one of the things we did was go after Cannon delegates who had been recruited by Cannon, promoted by Cannon, and elected as Cannon delegates at their caucuses. And then we discovered the Cannon organization had ignored them, thinking, okay, they're secure. And I sat down with them one-on-one, and I started getting Cannon delegates, and they could vote secretly for me, and the Cannon organization had no idea. And I've talked to Dan Lillenquist. He said, we picked off a whole bunch of Orrin Hatch delegates. The polls showed Orrin Hatch with 85% of the delegates pledged to him in the convention, and Orrin got 58% of the vote. So I think there's a major flaw in the philosophy that says these people represent us. If they did represent them, they vote on the record and come back to you and have to respond. So is when Count My Vote going to win? Don't know. But they've got good money and good organizational skills behind them, and it will be the most interesting fight of the 2014 campaign. All right, in the back. Oh, microphone here.
Yeah, all right. Hello, Senator Bennett. My name is Kurt Manwaring, and I'm studying political science here at the U. And I kind of wanted to take this back to your time serving in the Senate. And I was curious, and this just comes from, you know, watching a lot of Senate sessions on C-SPAN. There seems to be a lot of you know, institutionalized collegiality or formal courtesy. You know, it seems like I could disagree with you on everything, but on the Senate floor, you would still be my esteemed colleague from Utah. So what I'm wondering is how much of that is forced?
If I really didn't like you, you'd be distinguished.
Fair enough. Okay, so how much of that's forced? How much of that is genuine? And if it's forced, how much of it is from sincere personal animosity versus just intense political disagreement?
It's enforced by the rule. You cannot insult one of your colleagues. The archaic term that's in the Senate rules is your words will be taken down. That is, they'll be taken down off the record. And the only time I ever saw it done was when my colleague Dirk Kempthorne from Idaho, a freshman like me, was making a point that Robert C. Byrd, the oldest and some ways most curmudgeon member of the Senate, didn't like. And Robert C. Byrd began to say fairly snide things about this young whippersnapper who didn't really understand anything. And Bob Dole came out of his cave onto the Senate floor and invoked the rule on Robert C. Byrd and had the words taken down in defense of Kempthorne's right to say what he was saying. And Byrd
immediately realized I had gone over the line and was mortified himself because of his respect for the rules of the Senate. The civility is in the rule, and you cannot engage in the kind of shouting and name-calling that goes on in many parliaments in the world. Now, how well do we get along? I can only speak for when I was there, and I must confess that I hear from my colleagues that this is breaking down now, and it's not in any way cause and effect because I left. It's just kind of coincidence. Every vote is a different vote. Every challenge, every issue is a different issue than the one that came before. And you legislate by building coalitions. That means the person who is with you on this vote may be against you on the next one. Or, vice versa, the one who is against you on this one may be the absolute crucial vote you have to have next time. So if you are a wise legislator, you never offend anybody. That was brought home very firmly to me by Trent Lott, who was the Republican leader, when we had one Republican desert us on a very emotional issue, vote with the Democrats, and some of the newer members of the Senate, particularly those who had come from the House, where collegiality is not the rule. We've got to punish him. Take away his committee assignments. Don't give him any money from the senatorial committee. We've got to discipline him. And Trent said, no, 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 no. You don't understand. The most important vote is the next one. And we're going to need him on the next one. And so don't make him mad. And I decided, I'm not going to clash with anybody regardless of their ideology. And on a personal basis, I'm going to remain friends with them no matter how repugnant I think their politics are. And out of that came some very interesting coalitions that helped me get some of the things I wanted done that I would never been able to get done otherwise. And one of the things I take a little bit of pride from, when I gave my farewell speech in the Senate, I had as many Democrats on the floor as I had Republicans. And I think that's a measure of what it is necessary in order to get things done. Now, today, everything is on a straight party line vote and everything takes 60 votes. And that was not the case while I was there. And that's a source of frustration, that if I were there, I would find service in the Senate far less satisfying than it was. I assure you that is not sour grapes. I have my colleagues who are there now come up to me and say, tell me what it's like on the outside. You know, is there really life after the Senate? This place isn't nearly as much fun as it used to be, and tell me how it's going for you. And I'm interested at the number of retirements that we're seeing that wouldn't otherwise have come. And I think that change in the context is one of the reasons why. Now, who gets the microphone? Okay. Can you pass it back when you're through? Because there are people in the back row that want to ask questions too.
Yes, Senator. So my name is Tad. I'm studying political science. So my question is, isn't one of the problems the Republican Party has is it's essentially being led by demagogues who are unaccountable to the people, who can spew whatever acid they want, but they can claim free speech, and yet nobody calls them out on it. But when Republican senators or congressmen do something that's against the interests of Rush Limbaugh, they get demagogued, they get crucified, and yet, so that's why nobody really stands up for anything anymore?
Well, the first thing you must understand is that there is no such thing as a Republican Party, just as there's no such thing as a Democratic Party. There are 50 Republican parties. And 50 Democratic parties. They come together once every 4 years for the purpose of anointing a candidate for president. So, go back to my earlier comment. If you are a Republican in New Jersey and you sound like Ted Cruz, you get booed out of the room. Chris Christie dominates New Jersey like the Colossus of Rhodes. And his whole approach to life is the antithesis of anything Ted Cruz does. Now, the media would prefer Ted Cruz because the one thing they teach you in journalism school is if it bleeds, it leads. The top story is the fight. The top story is the quarrel. The top story is when there's blood on the floor. But I love the comment Christie made when some Republican said, well, isn't our problem the biased media? And the media will never tell the true story about Republicans. And he said, that's an excuse, not a reason. The media was biased against Ronald Reagan, and he carried 49 states. And if you will focus on getting things done, even though the media will be screaming and yelling about Ted Cruz, you can get things done. And he's proven that in New Jersey, the bluest of all blue states. He won solely because of the corruption in state government and the incompetence of his incumbent opponent. And he's winning re-election in that blue state by over 25 points. And one of the interesting things he said, lesson for all of us, back to the philosophy I'm trying to promote, he said when he became governor, or got elected, before he was inaugurated, he went to Tom Kaine, who was the Republican governor of New Jersey, deeply revered, highly successful, many years before. And he took his legal pad and his pens and all the rest of it, and he said, I'm going to take notes, and Tom Kaine is going to tell me how to succeed as governor. And Tom Kaine said, put down your pad, put down your pencil, and answer me one question. Who is your closest and dearest friend in all the world? Christie said, my wife. Tom Kaine said, wrong. Steve Sweeney. Who is Steve Sweeney? He's the Democratic president of the state Senate. He said, if you do not make Steve Sweeney your closest and dearest friend in all the world, you will fail as governor. Christie went on to say, I have dinner with Steve Sweeney so often. I spend so much time with Steve Sweeney. My wife says to me, is there something I need to know here? Something going on here? He said, the Christie-Sweeney reform of New Jersey's finances, including a restructuring of all of New Jersey's state pensions that put New Jersey on a sound financial footing. Does this sound like a Republican? It was the Christie-Sweeney bill, and he had the support of the Democrats in the state legislature in a state where Republicans do not matter. That's the way you legislate. That's the way you get things done. That's the way Ronald Reagan dealt with Tip O'Neill. That's the way Dwight Eisenhower dealt with Sam Rayburn. Leave them to their own devices and not have their respective caucuses putting pressure on them. That's the way Mitch McConnell will deal with Harry Reid. That's why when we were having all of the disaster leading up to the shutdown, and Boehner couldn't talk to Obama, and all of the rest of that was going on, and then they said, it's all up to Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. I said, okay, it's all over. It's done. Those are two of my closest friends in the Senate. I know them both intimately well. And if those two are going to sit down in a closed room without anybody else beating on the doors, they will come up with a solution and everything will be fine. So the Republicans are not led by screamers like Ted Cruz. The Republicans, they're in the wilderness because they lost the presidency. They need to get back a congressional structure that works, which doesn't right now. And what I'm hoping is that out of all of this, Boehner will now become a stronger speaker than he was, and Boehner in a position to say to his caucus, okay, guys, you marched us over the cliff once. We're not going to march over the cliff again. He's a deal maker. He's a pragmatic politician. And Mitch getting some support on the Republican side. But if Mitch loses to a Tea Party candidate, the seat will then go Democratic. Then Republicans have problems.
My name is Vivian Nguyen, and I was wondering, what was the most difficult decision you've ever had to make as senator?
What is the most difficult decision I've ever had to make as a senator? Now, that's an interesting challenge. I've never put it in quite those terms. I was always, maybe it's an act of arrogance on my part, but I was always fairly comfortable with the decisions that I made on the various pieces of legislation. The most agonizing situation I went through, and I won't bore you with the details, was when I had taken a position and I got talked out of it. Senator A wanted me to do this. It made sense to me. I agreed. And then Senator B convinced me that for tactical reasons, not substantive ones, I should change my position. And I agreed to do it. And then had to confront Senator A and tell him I was not going to be with him on his amendment. And he said, "You're a co-sponsor of the amendment." And he cut me off before I could make any conversation at all. He said, "You, of all people, going back on your word." And there I was, trapped. I'd given my word, and then I had given my word. And that was while I was still a relatively new senator, and I learned, you don't ever do that. You don't ever do that. And I was almost physically ill trying to figure out how to get out of this. It was nobody's fault but mine. Incredible stupidity. And I was swayed by the arguments, and how do I get out of this? I picked up the phone and called Trent Lott, who was the majority leader. And I said, "Trent, I have a problem." "Well, Trent." "Well, Bob, what's your problem?" And I told him, and he said, "Ooh, you really do have a problem." And then he, the experienced legislator, found a way out and outlined it for me. You tell Senator B this, and then you go back and tell Senator A that, and this makes B happy, and you can go back to A. And I followed Trent's pattern, and Senator A was, "I couldn't believe that you would break your word. Couldn't believe. I'm so glad you got the senator." And Senator B was, "Well, if you can solve my problem this other way, then I'm fine, and you can go back and so on." I learned never, ever to do that, which taught me another lesson, to use the term that we use in the Senate. You should keep your powder dry. Now, that's a military term about ammunition for artillery fire, but what it means is don't commit too early. Don't commit until you've got all the facts. Don't commit immediately. So people would come to see me with wonderful ideas. After that experience, I always said, "Well, what you're saying sounds really logical, and I think I will be able to be with you, but I want to check it out." And that saved me from a lot of embarrassment. Most of the time, when I checked it out, I was with them. My first instincts were correct. But I learned, even if you have good instincts and your first instincts are correct, there's always the possibility that something else will come along that will put you in a position where you've got great difficulty.
Hi, Mr. Bennett. I'm a student here studying political science as well. My question is to do with how you talked about the civil rights movement and how that was a big benefit to the Republican Party, like choosing that government intervention solution.
It wasn't necessarily a benefit to the Republican Party.
Oh, well,
it was the right thing for the country.
The right thing for the country. My question would have to do, that could be seen as an appeal to minority rights as well. And minorities in general with the Republican Party have had their differences. How do you see the Republicans appealing to minority groups in the future? Thank you.
Well, the most important thing the Republicans can and should do that is long overdue is get rational about immigration. I was in the middle of that one. We went into the vote on the immigration bill proposed by President George W. Bush. We needed 60 votes for cloture, and we had 59 commitments. And 40 of them were Democrats. Now, that's outrageous. This is a Republican president. He's been a border state governor. He understands immigration better than any of the rest of us. Living in Texas, for heaven's sakes, it has the longest border with Mexico, dealing with the border economy, and he's saying, this is the way to deal with immigration, and I'm going to stand here and say, I know more about this than you do, Mr. President? I said, I trust the president on this. The arguments he makes make sense to me. But we had only 19 Republicans and 40 Democrats. Trent and I were going over, Trent had become the whip by that time. I had been part of the whip organization, and we were going over the list and checking names. Trent said, well, we've only got 59, but I can't tell you how many times I've walked on the floor one or two votes down, rolled the dice, and won anyway, and that's just what we're going to have to do. So we went on the floor, started calling the roll, knowing we were one down, looking around for whom we might get for the 60th vote. And one of the Democrats we were depending on dropped off. So now we needed two. So Harry was looking around to try to find a Democrat to fill in that slot, and another Democrat dropped off. Now we needed three. Well, a Republican dropped off. So we needed four. Well, at that point, Mitch said, it's a jailbreak. Everyone's freed from his commitment. Vote however you think is the best way for you to vote. We ended up with 46. Out of 59 commitments, we got 46 votes. And someone said to me, Bob, you should consider changing your vote too. And looking back on it, in terms of my own career, that was probably right, because it was my vote on immigration that broke whatever tenuous ties I had with the far right in Utah. They were furious at me. And that was the beginning of, we've got to get rid of Bennett. But I said, no, I'm not going to cast a different vote. This is the right thing to do, and looking back on it, I still think it was the right thing to do. Out of that whole rhetoric, Tom Tancredo and the other people in the Republican Party who stepped forward to take the position of leadership on that, they wouldn't quote George W. Bush, they quote Tom Tancredo, came the notion that Republicans hate Hispanics. George W. Bush got 47% of the Hispanic vote. Mitt Romney got 27%. That's the place to start. That's the fastest growing demographic in the country. You look at the values and lifestyles of that demographic, they're all Republican. They don't think like Democrats. But they've just gotten the message that Republicans don't like people with brown skins. So we better vote Democrats because they like us. It's one of the dumbest possible things the Republicans can do. And interestingly enough, Marco Rubio comes to the Senate. The bill passes the Senate, basically the same bill I voted for. There were some changes. Bill passes the Senate, this time with a lot of Republican votes, and then gets killed in the House. This is dumb time. Now, how they reach out to African Americans, that one will take longer, can be worked on, can be done. Trent Lott in Mississippi. You notice how I pronounced it like Trent does? Mississippi. Trent Lott in Mississippi would go to all the black churches and sit down with the black leaders and say, what's on your mind? And when they got through, he'd say, y'all, a bunch of Republicans. That's what I believe, too. Trent didn't play the race card, and Trent always got reelected in Mississippi by very large margins. It can be done if you're willing to do it. Okay.
Hello, Senator.
There's a familiar face.
It's nice to see you again. My name is Satine Tashnizi, and I'm a political science major in pre-med. This country has a lot of substantial and significant problems that the United States is not talking about, the American people, the media, or Congress. We argue about gun control versus abortion and do not address any of the real problems. Whose responsibility is it to actually talk about what needs to be done?
Well, when you're running for office, you talk about what the people who will vote for you want you to talk about. There is a responsibility, I believe, for a political leader to go beyond that and talk about the great issues. You've sat in my class, you've heard me say that we have great issues and we have great diversions. And we spend most of our time arguing about the great diversions. And we don't address the great issues. So I think it is the responsibility of a political leader to address the great issues, outline what they are, and talk about them. As I have done my best to talk about what I consider to be the great issues in America, I have found, at least within Utah, scant interest in those issues, and they immediately want to get me to the issue that's important to them. And if you refuse to address the issue that's important to them, you're demonstrating an elitism and an aloofness that they will punish at the polls. So one of the reasons that we spend so much time on the great diversions is that the American people are more interested in the great diversions than the great issues. So we have think tanks that do their best to come up with what the great issues are. I don't get anybody guessing. I think one of the greatest issues we face in the United States today is our educational system. We are not preparing the graduates of our educational system for the kind of economy in which they will live. We have a great disconnect between the needs of the economy and the skills that people are learning in K through 12, and then in the higher education field. I think that's a huge issue. And we're not talking about it very much, except to scream about, well, let's have charter schools and vouchers. That'll solve the problem. Well, not really. The evidence is that you know, you're nibbling around the edges, and that's one of the great issues. And we spend time arguing over who was responsible for the shutdown. Was it really Obama, or was it Boehner? And you read the political blogs, and that's what they're going at. So if people will stand up and say, these are the great issues, and I will go behind a politician that will embrace them, and then political leaders will say, this is one of the great issues, vote for me, and I will go tackle it. That's the only way you get it resolved. Okay. Is the time gone? Last question.
All right. Well, I'm happy to give the last question. I want to go back. You gave a pretty grim forecast for the Tea Party and the future elections in nationally if things don't change, if they, particularly you pointed out, if they elect or nominate a Tea Party candidate. And so my question, I'm fairly involved in Utah politics here and in the party here, and the Tea Party, they don't always get the they have a pretty bad reputation, and they're not always as bad as the media would make them out to be. And I know you're familiar with
right. Not
being as bad as the media would make you out to be. What can specifically the Tea Party, the far-right faction of the Republican Party, do to try and not get lost in the wilderness, as you said? How can they stay and have an impact and fight for their principles without alienating themselves and losing?
If I may go back to Chris Christie,
And no, I'm not on his payroll, and I'm not part of his campaign for president. But he summarized it about as well as I've ever heard anybody do when he said, never compromise your principles, but be willing to adjust your assumptions. Okay, the challenge for anybody in politics, be they a far right, far left, middle, whatever it might be, is to be able to differentiate between a rock-solid principle and an assumption. I never violated any of my principles. I cast a few votes, looking back on it, that I'm not particularly proud of, mainly to pander. You know, my staff was saying to me, you're losing among the far right, the convention's going to be nasty, this doesn't count, the outcome isn't affected, and if you throw them a bone here, and I would say, well, normally, but you're right, I don't really feel that strongly about it, and I'll throw them a bone. Looking back on it in my career, I wish I hadn't done that. If I was going to lose, I might as well lose pure all the way through. But no politician is ultimately pure. Gordon Smith said to me, you know, after he'd been there about 5 years, he said, when you voted at subcommittee, full committee, on the floor, conference report, and final passage, you've been on every side of every issue. Sooner or later, the circumstance of each vote is different, and sooner or later, you will have cast a vote that puts you on every side of every issue. I voted with the trial lawyers. It was amazing. I cast a vote based on one of my principles, which happened to be the same thing they wanted. Quick anecdote. The next day, they showed up in my office with a $2,000 campaign contribution. And my chief of staff said, what do I do with this? And I said, deposit the check immediately. All the money we Republicans can take from the trial lawyers is a good deal. I think on both sides in the state of Utah, there are, quote, establishment Republicans who are just as angry and just as unreasonable about their Tea Party brethren as there are Tea Party Republicans who are angry and unreasonable about their establishment brethren. And if we can get back to the concept that I outlined before, that the core of the Republican Party is their belief in free markets of ideas, free markets in the economy, free markets in the way people solve their problems, and that we turn to government only when free markets are not working. Okay, we can disagree on details, but let's hang on to that notion of freedom in the idea, the marketplace of ideas, and freedom in the economy that holds us together as Republicans. Then we can coexist and work together against people who hold a different core idea. But if in both sides, the other guy has to be excommunicated, humiliated, and excoriated at every turn for his failure to live up to the true religion, then we're in the land that Eric Hoffer talked about when he wrote the book called True Believers and described how much trouble true believers really get you into. People say, I'm a man of principle. Adolf Hitler was a man of principle, deeply held principles. You read Hitler, you read the philosophers in Germany that were feeding him and agreeing with him and to whom he was providing leadership. They held deeply, deeply rooted principles. The most serious one being anti-Semitism. And I'm going to be, how true was Adolf Hitler to that principle? In the midst of a war, when there is tremendous demand on your resources, both human resources, humans needed at the front, and physical resources, armaments and so on, he was running extermination camps using resources to follow the principle. Stick to your principles, but adjust your assumptions
And many things that people are thinking are false principles are really nothing more than assumptions that they have made. And the more you can begin to understand that and make those kinds of adjustments, the more you can get along with people and the more you can get things done. So I would appeal to both sides in this divide in the Utah Republican Party. Stick to your principles, but let's start talking about some of the things you are saying and examining them to see if they maybe are just assumptions that need a little bit of adjustment.
On behalf of the Hinckley Institute, we'd like to thank Senator Bennett for giving us an excellent and informative forum.